help me. Darling, she said, helping is the worst thing I could do for you. After I finish telling Gazella my story, nothing is off the table. I tell her how I wrote to Mother to tell her she had a grandson and still she didn't reply. I tell her how I sent her pictures of Ollie every year. How one day I caught the train to my childhood home to check that my parents still lived there and saw my father's car parked in the driveway and Mother in the garden pulling weeds. I tell her how Mother looked right at me, then lowered her straw hat so it covered her face and went back to weeding. I tell her how that was the last time I saw Mother before she died, 4 years later. That after Mum's funeral, I never saw my father again. I'm sorry, Gazella says. It is what it is. I moved forward with my life and started a new family. I have Tom and the children now. But your children are unhappy with you? I sigh. Because of money. It's always about money. Your children want your money? Naturally. And you don't want to give it? I smile. There's something so delightfully simple about the way Gazella speaks. No double entendre, no judgment. It frees me to speak equally simply. Being poor and having to survive without my parents was the single most defining thing I've ever done. It showed me what I was capable of. As a mother, I think this is the most important gift you can give to your children. Unlike money, it can't be taken away or lost. It sounds like you have your answer, Gazella said. But it's more complicated than that. Nettie wants to have a baby and she's having trouble getting pregnant. IVF is very expensive and she wants us to help her with the cost. The clock is ticking as she's 40 now. And that's not even the whole picture. I have reason to believe that her husband is unfaithful. Gazella's brown eyes widen. Does she know? I'm not sure. The funny thing is, I'm not sure she'll want to know. This baby thing has sent her quite mad. She's got her eye on the prize, a baby, and she's unable to see anything else.
So instead of talking to her about it, you're ensuring she won't get pregnant by withholding money?
As I've said, I have many reasons not to give her the money. But to be honest, yes, I'd rather not help her shackle herself to a man who is possibly unfaithful. She's already struggling. I couldn't bear for her to become pregnant, give up her livelihood and her career, only to have it thrown back in her face when he leaves her for another woman. I look at Gazella, waiting for some wisdom or comment or even a question. But Gazella doesn't say anything at all, which, I realize, is a much more powerful response.
Chapter 31. Lucy. The present. No iPads, I tell the kids to a chorus of moans. They have just gotten home from school and my front hall is full of school bags, my sink is full of lunchboxes, and my couch is full of children. Go play a game or read a book. They proceed to go ballistic, and I ask myself, why am I doing this? Who cares if they watch the iPad for 24 hours straight? Their eyeballs won't bleed or turn square, their brains won't rot. It doesn't matter a single jot. And yet I continue my mothering on autopilot, as natural to me these days as breathing, even in spite of everything going on. Ollie came home from the will reading and immediately shut himself up in the home office. He didn't say much in the car, other than that he was still in shock and needed some time to think. He hasn't been back to work yet since Diana died, and I'm starting to worry about that. For the past year, it's been so hard to keep him away from the place. He regularly worked weekends and well into each evening. I'd hoped that by this point, 4 years into the business, he'd have been able to back off a little and enjoy what they'd built, but they always seem to be hurtling toward the next target.
When we sign this client, we'll be able to take the kids to Disneyland. When we land this contract, champagne for everyone.
But they kept signing clients and landing contracts, and Ollie kept placing candidates, and still, profits seemed to be skinny. A year ago, I'd suggested Ollie and Eamon get someone to look at the books, to do an inventory of incomings and outgoings. Ollie had liked that idea, and came home and reported that Eamon had hired an accountant he knew to do exactly that. But the accountant had come back with the same advice that Eamon had been giving. More clients equals more money. A good philosophy, but with Ollie as the only recruiter and no money to hire anyone else, it had taken its toll on him. Now, to hear that his parents had disinherited him, it's got to feel like the final straw in what has been a stressful couple of years. From the living room, I hear Ollie's phone ring and then quickly stop. He's screening the call, probably. He's been doing that all day. I imagine him in his swivel chair, his forehead resting against the desk. Ollie and I had never talked explicitly about the fact that we would one day come into money. It always seemed to be in poor taste. But even I could admit that I'd thought about it from time to time, and it always made me feel secure to know that even if we were poor now, our retirement would be taken care of. The idea that Diana would cut all of us out of her will had never occurred to me, and it had clearly never occurred to Ollie either. There is a sharp bang-bang at the door. My stomach constricts. Lately, a bang at the door has always signaled bad news, and given the amount of force this person is using, it seems unlikely that this one should be any different. I tread slowly down the hall. Through the window at the side of the door, I notice the distinctive royal blue of Eamon's suit jacket. When I toss open the door, he straightens his spine, bending his lips upward in what I think is supposed to be a smile.
"Hi, Luz."
"Eamon," I say, "is everything all right?" His expression is tight and he has a slight twitchiness about him that is unnerving.
"Sure, sure, everything's great, fantastic."
Fantastic. Ollie had started using that word too since being in partnership with Eamon, mostly on the phone.
"Everything is fantastic. How are things with you, Steve? Fantastic."
Someone must have told them in a networking course that it is highly important to be fantastic at all times.
"Ollie home?"
he says. Ollie is already behind me. I feel him there even before I turn and see him. I take a step back and watch the men regard each other, squaring up against one another like cats in the street.
"Good day, mate," Ollie says, unsmiling. "Good day,"
Eamon replies equally coolly.
"Sorry to intrude, just wanted a quick word."
Ollie turns and walks back down the hall, and Eamon follows. I find myself overcome by an urge to go after them, to demand to know what on earth is going on. But Ollie closes the door.
"Mum?"
I startle. It's Harriet. She appears before me looking utterly appalled.
"What?"
"Archie is watching the iPad."
"Oh."
I walk into the living room. Edie has managed to turn on the television and is staring at Play School open-mouthed.
"Where is he?"
"He's in his bed hiding,"
Harriet wails.
"It's not fair. Mum!"
I follow Harriet to Archie's room, where she points an accusing finger at the suspicious mound in the centre of the bed. I tug off the blankets and Archie looks up guiltily.
"I said no iPad," I say without much force. The fact is, I'm thinking of reconsidering this whole no iPad thing. I could really use the time to try and unpack my thoughts, not to mention to eavesdrop on the conversation between Ollie and Eamon.
"Now I get it for the rest of the day,"
Harriet says, lunging for the iPad.
"No, you don't,"
Archie cries. I grab the iPad and exit the room, and Archie and Harriet tailgate me down the hall, a swishing appendage of fury. I pause outside Ollie's office door. The volume has risen now, so I don't have to strain to hear the sound of a fist hitting something. The wall? The desk? Then I hear Ollie's voice.
"How the fuck was I supposed to know?"
The kids freeze. I concentrate on keeping my face neutral as I circle around the kids and start pushing them toward the family room.
"This is bullshit!" Eamon cries. "This is fucking bullshit!"
There is a terrific crash, and the kids and I pull up short at the same time as the door flies open and Eamon comes crashing out. Ollie's hands are wrapped tight around his throat. Chapter 32. Lucy. The Past. There is truly nothing worse than having to ask for a favour when you're trying to hold the moral high ground. It's been 3 months since Christmas, and we're in the sweaty, summer-is-never-going-to-end period when people hang out at the supermarket in swimsuits and flip-flops buying watermelon and ham and bread rolls and sunscreen. I'd like to be hanging out at the supermarket too, since it's air-conditioned, but I'm too ill to even lift my head off the couch, because I am 8 weeks pregnant. If it wasn't for Harriet, I could have coped. Archie could have watched The Wiggles on repeat and wouldn't have bothered me for days, except maybe for food. But Harriet, at 10 months, has not yet mastered the art of solid, uninterrupted screen time. Ollie has a full day of interviews at work, but he has promised to come home as soon as he can. And my dad is down at Port Arlington for the week. I think about hiring an agency nanny, but my eyes water at the cost, and Ollie has been watching the pennies lately. Finally, I realise there's nothing else for it, and I ring Diana.
Hello?
As always, she answers the phone, sounding mildly inconvenienced. I'm flat on my back on the floor with Archie on my lap and Harriet banging a toy repeatedly against my head. Hello, Diana, I say. How are you?
Lucy?
There's a short pause.
Are you ill?
Leave it to Diana to cut to the chase. Actually, yes, that's why I'm calling. I have the flu and I'm feeling quite shocking. I decided not to tell Diana I was pregnant until I reached the 3-month mark. With my previous two pregnancies, I couldn't wait to tell her, thinking she'd enjoy being in on the early secret. But both times she'd merely smiled and assured me she'd keep it to herself until we were out of the danger period. There had been no congratulations, no hug. She did, bizarrely, drop off bags of grapes periodically with both pregnancies. So this time I decided she could find out around the 3-month mark, like everyone else.
And you need help with the kids?
It's not a question, nor is it an offer, though I have to respect the way she doesn't waste anyone's time. Yes. I hear shuffling in the background. Diana flicking through her diary, perhaps. She'll have a full calendar, no doubt, but I'm holding out hope that she'll find a half-hour slot somewhere, between 2:30 and 3 p.m, but it has to be a 3 p.m. sharp pickup because I have to take a baby carriage across town and I'd like to get back before the rush hour traffic. Fact is, I'm not too proud to take that half hour. I'll take anything I can get.
I'm free, she says after a moment. I'll come and pick them up right away.
I blink. You'll pick them up?
I just have to reschedule a drop-off, but that won't take long. I'll be there within the hour.
When Diana knocks on my door, I'm still horizontal, but I've moved to the couch. Archie is glued to the iPad, and Harriet is sitting on my stomach, whining for attention. The floor is littered with cushions, the coffee table with toast crumbs, plates, mugs, and oddly, one of my wedding shoes. Kids. I don't try to conceal any of the mess. It's all I can do to answer the door. Diana has pharmacy bags.
I stopped at the drugstore. I have Lemsip. Apparently it's nothing more than acetaminophen, but I always find it comforting when I'm sick. I also have cold and flu tablets. Take 2 right after we leave and get some sleep.
Diana takes Harriet.
Right, I'll pack a bag for the kids.
Diana swishes about the place, finding a weekend bag and stuffing it full of the kids' clothes. She finds bottles and formula and a couple of jars of baby food, which she efficiently loads into the diaper bag, along with some diapers and wipes and pacifiers. I'm helpless to do anything but lie there and watch.
All right, kids, she says when she's filled 2 bags. You're coming for a sleepover at Dido's.
This is exciting enough to tear Archie from his screen. A sleepover? Diana has never had the kids for a sleepover before. Not even Archie.
Sleepovers at Grandma's were something that only ever happened in my dreams. Also evidently in Archie's dreams, judging by the way he runs around in circles now. Archie adores Tom and Diana's house. The games of hide-and-seek are epic, and he is remarkably unfazed by Diana's unceasing monologue about how he isn't to touch or break anything. I do worry about the stairs, marble, of course, and Harriet, who is just starting to crawl, but right now I decide it's worth the risk. "Be careful of Harriet on the stairs," I say to Diana as she gathers up the kids. Suddenly I realize I haven't thanked her for anything. I open my mouth to do that, but before I do, another thought jumps into my brain. "And don't let them near the pool." Call me crazy, but I have a terror of kids and pools. Tom and Diana have an indoor swimming pool, obviously, and they have managed to get around the mandatory pool fencing laws by having high door handles and auto-closing doors. It's all well and good, except that Archie loves going into the pool area to look at the giant aquarium fish tank they have installed, of course, and if Diana got distracted by Harriet, I didn't want to think about what could happen. "No one in the pool area," Diana agrees, and she disappears out the door with my children. That's when I realize I never did say thank you. I sleep. An unfathomable, all-consuming orgasm of a sleep. Pregnancy will do that to you. I haven't slept like this in years. My dreams are odd and ever-changing, and I rouse every few hours only to realize that my children aren't here and I can go back to sleep indefinitely. It's unthinkably luxurious. I find myself wanting to savor every second. Around 5 p.m. when I rouse again, the phone is ringing. I snatch it from the bedside table and press it to my ear, eyes still closed. "Hello?" It sounds more like "No." "Lucy?" I open my eyes. It's Diana. I can tell right away, even though her pitch sounds different, a note or two higher than usual. "Yes?" I hear talking in the background, unfamiliar voices speaking urgently. I feel a chill slip down my spine, a sluice of ice water. I rise to my elbows. "What is it, Diana? What's happened?" "We're on our way to the hospital, Lucy," she says. Her voice is threaded through with fear. "You need to meet us there." Chapter 33. Lucy. The present. Eamon is gone. Thankfully, I didn't need to break up the fight. As soon as Ollie had seen us watching, he'd released Eamon, who'd brushed himself off and stalked out the front door. Ollie also brushed himself off, and then turned and walked back into his office without a word. I'd left him alone only long enough to get the children in front of their screens, and now I knock on the door firmly. "Come in," he says. Ollie is sitting in his chair, his elbows on his knees, his head in his hands. He doesn't look up. "What's going on?" I ask. He keeps his head down, which does nothing to ease my anxiety. I think about all the things I know about him. The way he eats his breakfast cereal dry, no milk. The fact that he sleeps naked all year round. His ferocious hatred of celery, so strong that he can tell the moment he walks in the door if it's been in the house. But clearly, there are a lot of things I don't know about him. "I'm sorry," he whispers. "Why are you sorry?" Finally, he looks up. His face is tear-stained. My mind goes to the very worst places. Actually, it goes to one particular place, very quickly. An image of Ollie appears in my mind, pressing a gold-threaded cushion into his mother's face. Was it possible? Certainly Diana had made me do things I never thought possible. Ollie takes a breath. "I'm sorry because we're ruined financially." It takes a moment for the relief to come, but when it does, it is a flood.
I drop to my knees in front of him and take his hands in my own. They're sweaty and warm, and I kiss them.
Oh, Ollie, no, we're not. Sure, we don't have millions upon millions of dollars coming our way, but we're not ruined. We've survived so far, haven't we? And we don't need much.
A beat of silence passes. Ollie keeps his eyes on the floor.
What?
This isn't about the inheritance. Well, I'd hoped the inheritance would save us. But
he drifts off. My mind reels back, suddenly sticking on the bank statement I opened a few days ago. The huge number, the debt, at the bottom. A panicky feeling starts in my chest.
The business?
Ollie nods.
How bad is it?
It's bad, Ollie says. We sunk so much into it the first year, setting it all up. I actually have no idea how we spent so much. The money just seemed to fly out of the account.
I sit back on my haunches.
We kept getting new contracts, and I was working my ass off, and we were making money, but not enough, it seems. I should have kept a closer eye on the outgoings, but I thought Eamon had it in hand.
He drags a hand through his hair.
When Mum died, I thought we could pay off our debts and leave the business behind once and for all. But now...
Now we have nothing.
Silence envelops us. I lift my hand to my temple. Now, not only are we not inheriting millions upon millions of dollars, we're also in extraordinary debt.
And Eamon doesn't have any money he can invest? I ask.
Eamon was counting on the money too. I talked about clearing the debt so he could keep the business operating.
I close my eyes. I hear the faint sounds of Sesame Street and the irritating melodic tune of one of Archie's games on the iPad.
And our savings?
Our savings are long gone.
Ollie begins to cry, real rolling tears.
We are in a huge amount of debt. Dad's dead, Mum's dead. There is no one to help us.
I'm furious with Ollie, but I crawl to him and put my arms around his neck. He's right. There's no one to help us now. The funny thing is, this is what Diana wanted all along.
Chapter 34. Diana. The past.
The truth is, I'd always intended to let Archie swim. I knew what Lucy had said, but I didn't see how it could hurt. After all, I was going to watch him. Before Archie could talk and tattle me in, I used to do even more things I knew Lucy wouldn't like. I wasn't doing it to spite her or anything. It was just that she worried about a lot of things that didn't matter.
"Make sure he wears his coat,"
she'd always say, as I disappeared out of the house with Archie. I'd nod and agree, but when Archie flung off his coat at the park, I wasn't going to chase after him to put it back on. Natural consequences were better. If the child was cold, he'd put the coat on.
"Did he nap for 2 hours at 1 p.m?"
she'd demand. "That sounds about right," I'd say. All this fuss about naps.
"No junk,"
she'd say when I was taking Archie to the movies. But what child didn't have popcorn and an ice cream cone when they went to a film with their grandmother? But clearly, she'd had a point, and I should have listened to her. Archie had been begging to go in the pool all day. And why not? I enjoyed a swim myself, and there was no question I wouldn't supervise him. I'd shower him afterward and he'd fall off to sleep exhausted and Lucy would be none the wiser. That's what I'd figured. And now, here we were, in the hospital. I thought I'd done everything right. I'd waited for Tom to get home. Harriet was too young to swim, and besides, I wouldn't have trusted myself with both kids in the pool at once. "Tom," I'd said when he walked in the door, "can you hold Harriet for me so I can swim with Archie?" For someone who was so fond of holding his grandchildren, Tom had been surprisingly reluctant.
"Oh, can't you just put her in the stroller?"
I think she'd prefer a cuddle from her grandfather.
Archie was already naked, running for the pool, leaving a trail of clothing in his wake.
Archie, don't run, I called after him.
The floor was limestone and slippery when wet. At one end was a giant aquarium, which I thought was over the top, but Tom insisted, and the children loved it.
Take Harriet up that end and let her look at the fish, I said.
Tom did, reluctantly. He was in a strange mood. I didn't know what was bothering him.
I slid inflatable armbands onto Archie and he dive-bombed into the pool while I got in slowly via the steps.
Tom carried Harriet over to the aquarium. She was a pudgy baby, shorter and much fatter than Archie had been. I watched her chunky legs kick insistently as she watched the fish swim past.
Watch this, Dido,
Archie said, and I watched him pretend to walk down the street and then accidentally fall into the pool. Funny little fellow. I glanced at Tom at the end of the pool and noticed Tom was holding Harriet strangely, sort of using his forearms to press her against him. By the time I realized she was slipping, it was too late. I pulled myself up and out of the pool, but I was still several meters away when Harriet slid from his grip and her head hit the limestone tiles with a crack. In the ambulance, I sing Old MacDonald Had a Farm. Old MacDonald had a farm, E-I-E-I-O. There is blood, a lot of blood. Heads bleed a lot, I remember someone saying that once. Lots of blood vessels close to the surface of the skin or something. With a quack quack here and a quack quack there. Harriet is awake, which is a good sign, but she's very distressed, has vomited twice, and a sizable bruise is already coming up on the side of her head. She seems drowsy, but it is her nap time. My job, the paramedic said, was to keep her awake. And so I sing. Here a quack, there a quack, everywhere a quack quack. It's funny the places the mind goes. My mind drifts from the idea that I may have permanently injured my grandchild to the question of why Tom dropped her at all. Mostly my mind sticks on what I'm going to say to Lucy. I know what it's like being told that you might not get to keep your baby. I remember that feeling as if it were yesterday. I cannot be the reason that Lucy has to hear these words. I run my fingers through Harriet's soft baby hair.
E-I-E-I-O.
Lucy and Ollie arrive at the hospital in a flurry. Ollie is in his work clothes minus the suit jacket. He must have come in such a hurry he didn't stop to put it on. Lucy is still dressed in the tracksuit she wore when I picked up the kids this morning. This morning feels like a lifetime ago. Lucy, I start, but she ignores me, rushing to Harriet's side. I cringe. Harriet looks terrible. Her head is bandaged, but blood soaks through the gauze. Lucy rears back in horror.
Is she unconscious?
At first, I think Lucy is talking to me, but then I realize there is a tired-looking doctor in the doorway. She's dressed in scrubs, and glasses dangle around her neck on a chain.
Your daughter has been sedated for an MRI, the doctor says. We do that with young children to make sure they'll lie still. Try not to worry.
Why does she need an MRI?
It's just a precaution. She has a depressed skull fracture, which may require surgery to lift the bone to prevent it pressing against the brain. We also need to check for cerebral lacerations and contusions, which are tears and bruises to the surface of the brain, the doctor says. This can happen when the skull is fractured. Your daughter was vomiting in the ambulance, so we want to make sure we don't miss anything. Chances are she'll be fine, but we can't be too careful with head injuries.
There is movement in the doorway, a nurse gesturing to the doctor. She nods, then looks back at Lucy.
I'm just going to check that we have everything ready here, and then we will be back to get Harriet.
Lucy turns back to Harriet. Ollie comes to stand beside her,
and she reaches out to grip his forearm. Lucy, I start, but she holds up a hand, silencing me.
Why were you in the pool?
She doesn't even face me to ask this. I'm sorry, I know you said no swimming, I just thought
that you knew better?
She whirls around, her eyes flash wild.
That you are entitled to override me in decisions about my children?
You have no idea how sorry I am, Lucy. Honestly, I am. But it's done now, and I think it would be better if we could just...
What?
A rush of air expels from Lucy, almost a laugh, not quite.
Put it behind us?
Well,
did you hear what the doctor said? Harriet needs an MRI. My daughter could have died because you thought you knew better than me.
She takes a step toward me. Lucy is usually hard to pin down. Like a child, she is in a state of perpetual movement. But right now, she's eerily calm and quiet. I find myself taking a step back.
I know we've never been close, Diana. First, there was my wedding day. I thought we'd shared a moment when you gave me that necklace. Then you felt the need to remind me that I had to give it back, which I knew, by the way, but pointing it out like I was planning to steal it wasn't the best way to ingratiate yourself to me.
She takes another step toward me.
You made me feel like a gold digger when we asked for money to buy a tiny worker's cottage. You know what? I didn't even want your money. It was Ollie's idea.
Lucy's entire body pulses.
You bring me a raw chicken when I have a newborn. A raw chicken!
I can actually see the flickers in Lucy's brain. Sparks, metal on metal, memory on memory. It all forms into a spinning cyclone, more powerful together than separate.
My baby might have brain damage because of you. We cannot ever put that behind us.
Lucy, Ollie says. I'd almost forgotten he was here. In the back of my thoughts, it occurs to me that Ollie is the fruit of my womb, yet at some point he's become almost insignificant. He and Tom and Patrick are the cogs and spokes, but Lucy and Nettie and I, we are the wheels.
You need to calm down.
Lucy takes another step toward me. A nurse appears in the doorway.
Is everything all right in here?
Lucy, I say, holding up my hands. Just take a breath. But Lucy thrusts a palm out, flat like a stop sign. It connects with my own hands and I stagger backward. I feel a sharp pain in my ankle and I go down hard.
We need security in here,
I hear someone call. Lucy disappears and people I don't recognize appear right up close.
Ma'am, are you all right? I need a doctor in here.
Are you all right, ma'am? Don't try to move her. They're making a big fuss about nothing. I'm fine. I'm on the floor now, I believe. Colour dances in front of my eyes. And then it's just black.
Chapter 35. Lucy. The present. I wear Diana's necklace to the funeral. The one she lent me on my wedding day. She'd left it to me in her will. When I'd tipped it out of its envelope this morning, there had been a little note attached.
At least this time, you don't have to give it back.
One thing to be said about Diana, she had an unexpected sense of humour. I'd planned to wear the necklace with my hot pink wrap dress, but instead I'd gone for a simple black shift. There was something to be said for black at funerals. And I did add a pair of hot pink wedges. Outside the funeral home are dozens of people who know my name and who talk about how we had met down at Sorrento or at Tom's 60th birthday party or some other such event. I nod and smile and ask after their families, but the small talk is achingly limited. All of the normal day-to-day topics are off the table, being deemed too trivial for the occasion, except, oddly, the weather, which is freely discussed at funerals and indeed one of the few safe topics of discussion. The sun is shining down on Diana today, or even the sky is crying. Interestingly, though, the sun is not shining and the sky is not crying. It is merely a dull, grey day. I wonder, idly, what this is supposed to say about my mother-in-law. Nettie is in quite a fragile state. She has dressed up, at least, in a cream dress and brown leather wedges, but she looks drawn and tired. She dissolves into fresh tears periodically, and I wish I could console her. But she won't even accept support from Patrick, who stands beside her uselessly, smiling politely at people who offer condolences. The children mill about at my heels, bored and excited, pinching and pushing each other, but they quiet down when I hand them a fistful of gummy bears from the stash in my bag. Inside, the crowd is the typical upper-middle-class folk, apart from the smattering of dark-skinned faces, rare enough among these parts to assume they must be the refugee ladies that Diana worked with. I notice Eamon as we make our way to the seats at the front. There's no physical sign of his fight with Ollie that I can see, other than perhaps the expression of mild defiance on his face. I'd have wondered why he bothered coming at all if I didn't know how into appearances he was. Jones and Ahmed are there too, which is a surprise. They wear their usual black suits, and as such should look like any other mourner, but there's something about them that screams cop. Perhaps it's that I can feel their presence, like ants crawling up my back. The service is slow and dull, in large part because of the lack of hymns. Ollie gives a eulogy that is as heartfelt as it can possibly be, which is to say fairly generic. Lots of I love yous, lots of stories about how Diana did lots of charitable work. As I listen, I can't help but think of the eulogy Ollie gave at Tom's funeral. There hadn't been a dry eye in the house. Ollie himself had become so choked up that I ended up standing behind him for most of it, with my hand on his shoulder. But today, he doesn't manage so much as a misty eye. I try to imagine the eulogy that I would have given Diana had I been given the role. I glance up at the photo of her framed on her coffin. Her chin is raised, her eyes guarded, her lips curved into the barest smile. It is so Diana, I can't help but feel something. It's hard to believe I won't see that guarded smile again. It's equally hard to believe that she might have exited this world on anything other than her own terms. I become aware of a flutter in my body, a niggle at first, but slowly it fills my chest like a scream. I put a hand gently to my lips, but a sob escapes, excruciatingly loud. The children look at me curiously. Even Ollie pauses in his eulogy and frowns. I want to get it together, but it's like a train. I double over, all at once consumed by it. The stark emotion. The utter, inexplicable loss. Ollie and Patrick are pallbearers, along with two friends of Tom's. The other two positions, apparently there is a requirement for six, are given to the funeral staff. I think briefly that perhaps those roles should have been offered to Nettie and myself. But no one asked me, and I assume no one asked Nettie either. And so Diana is taken out and placed in the hearse, and we are forced to endure small talk for another 45 minutes as my children tear around the lawn like they're at a garden party. Harriet has climbed a tree and is sitting on a branch with a child I saw in the venue, a grandchild of one of Diana's friends, perhaps. The hems of their dresses are grubby with dirt. People disappear in dribbles, most heading to the function room at the Half Moon Hotel, where we are putting out sandwiches and drinks this afternoon. But a few people who aren't heading to the Half Moon hang around to give their condolences. Condolence after condolence in the absence of alcohol is, quite frankly, exhausting. Ollie obviously thinks so, judging by his drawn expression, so I tell him to head out and leave me to farewell the final few mourners.
"What about the kids?"
he says. "I'll handle the kids. Go." Finally he does, catching a ride with an old friend of Tom's. I am standing there with Edie hanging off one leg when another mourner approaches me. She's young, perhaps 5 or 10 years younger than me, and her skin a beige-brown colour. The man beside her looks vaguely familiar.
"You are Lucy," the woman says.
"Yes," I say. My gaze moves back to the woman. I don't think I've seen her before, but then again there have been a lot of people here today that I haven't recognised.
"Have we met?" She smiles.
I have seen your picture at Diana's house.
She's wearing a black long-sleeved dress and black boots with an emerald green headscarf.
I am Gezala. This is my husband, Hakem.
It's nice to meet you both. How did you know Diana?
I was pregnant when I came to Australia, Gezala says. Diana was wonderful to me. She was there when I gave birth to my son Arash on my kitchen floor.
That was you? I exclaim. I remember hearing about that. It's hard to forget the image of Diana on the floor, let alone delivering a baby.
Gezala smiles. She was a very good woman.
And what do you do, Lucy? Hakem asks.
I'm a stay-at-home mum at present, I tell him. I've been asked this a lot today. What are you up to these days, Lucy? What are you doing with yourself now that you've finished having babies?
Usually I don't care what other people think, but with our soon-to-be bankrupt status, I can't help but wonder, what am I doing with myself? I'd been so determined to be a stay-at-home mum, so keen to do as my own mother did, that I'd never questioned it. Now, suddenly, I was questioning it.
I was a recruiter in a past life, I start, but Hakem cuts me off.
It must be in the family. Diana found me my job several years ago when I couldn't get an interview in this country. Now I am an engineer again, because of Diana.
That's when I realize where I know him from. That day at Diana's house. I remember the way he thanked her, the extent of his gratitude. I remember the way Diana had brushed it off like it was no big deal.
Actually, just yesterday Hakem and I were invited to have seats on the board of Diana's charity, Gezala says. It was her wish that the board have representation from refugees.
That doesn't surprise me, I say. Diana was passionate about that charity.
We will make sure her legacy is carried on. We will make her proud.
I pause, thinking about how that was all I had wanted for the longest time, to make Diana proud. Gezala takes my hand.
Diana was in the business of giving people chances, she says. But maybe she was so busy looking at the problems in the world, she forgot to give chances to those right under her nose.
I smile at Gezala, and just like that, after her death, I understand Diana a little better.
Chapter 36. Diana. The past.
Are you sure you're all right? Tom says to me as I slide out of my hospital gown. I'm fine. It was a small knock to the head. It was a lot of fussing about nothing. The hospital only kept me overnight in case I sued them for a slippery floor or something. I step into the trousers Tom brought for me. I still can't believe Lucy pushed you. She was worried about Harriet, Tom, as we all are. That should be our focus right now, not this silly bump to my head. I slip on my blouse and start matching up the buttons.
Are we going to pop up to the ward to see Harriet before we go? Tom asks.
I hesitate. I don't think I should.
Nonsense, you're her grandmother.
Lucy made it very clear.
Lucy was emotional. She didn't mean what she said or did. She'll probably apologize when she sees you.
Tom is the eternal optimist, but I don't share his confidence. He didn't see the emotion behind Lucy's words. Since yesterday, the only news I've had was a text from Ollie saying, Harriet awake, MRI looked good. I'd heard nothing at all from Lucy, despite calling three times.
I'm not sure about that, Tom. We'll stop by on our way to the car, he says firmly. It will all be fine, you'll see.
When we arrive at Harriet's room, Lucy is sitting on a chair that has been pushed up to Harriet's bedside. Her back is to us. From the doorway, I can hear her humming Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, even though Harriet appears to be sound asleep. She's a good mother, I have to admit. It occurs to me that I've never told her that.
Tom lifts his hand to knock on the door, but I grab it just before it connects.
I just want to watch them, I whisper. Let's just watch for a moment.
And so we watch, and for the first time I really see Lucy. Not a girl who was handed everything. A girl who knew what she wanted. A family. A girl who has stood by my son and her children and even me, in spite of hardship. A girl a lot tougher than I gave her credit for. I think about all my conversations with Jan and Liz and Kathy about daughters-in-law. We'd always focused on how different they are from us, how their mothering is different, their attitudes are different. We've never once focused on our similarities, as women, as wives, as mothers. It occurs to me suddenly that there are a lot more of them. Let's go, I say to Tom. He looks as though he's going to protest, but I pull him out of the doorway before he can. Lucy won't want us here today. And today, I'm thinking about her. Tom and I drive home in silence. I assume the quiet is to allow me to process my thoughts about what happened with Lucy, but when we pull up in front of the house and Tom doesn't get out of the car straight away, I realize I'd assumed wrong.
This was all my fault, he says. I'm the one who dropped Harriet.
Nonsense. I release my seatbelt and pivot in my seat. It was an accident.
Accidents have been happening for a while. My grip strength has been getting worse and worse.
I roll my eyes. We're getting older, Tom. Nothing works as well as it used to.
I went to the doctor about it a couple of months ago.
I pause. You did?
Dr. Paisley ordered some tests and told me I should see a specialist, a neurologist, so I did.
You did what? Saw a specialist?
I'm stunned.
How could this have been going on without my knowing? Tom doesn't have secrets.
Once, when the kids were little, he told them on Christmas Eve that Santa had told him he was going to bring them bikes the next day.
I just couldn't wait to see their little faces, he'd said.
Tom stares straight ahead, his hands on the wheel at 10 and 2. I haven't seen the specialist yet, but I have an appointment tomorrow. It's with a guy who specializes in motor neuron disease. It's also known as ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease.
I stare at him.
I didn't want to tell you until I had more information, but after what happened, it's my fault what happened to Harriet. I should never have agreed to hold her.
My throat is dry. I try to swallow, but there's nothing there. I stare at the side of Tom's face, his large, craggy face.
I'd like you to come with me to my appointment tomorrow.
Of course I'll come. I wish I had been there for all your appointments.
I know you do,
he says. And he lets go of the steering wheel and lays one hand palm up in my lap. We sit like that in the car for nearly an hour, staring at the windshield. The next day, Tom and I go to the neurologist's office. We enter the waiting room, announce our arrival, and take our seats on a couple of chairs. In the space beside me, a man sits in a wheelchair, head lolling, his chin supported by a white pad, a purple travel pillow horseshoeing his neck. He is, at a glance, at least 10 years younger than Tom. The woman beside him, his wife presumably, flicks through a magazine, glancing up at him every so often and smiling, or leaning forward with a tissue to wipe the corner of his mouth. Even after the lady sees me looking, I'm unable to look away.
Tom Goodwin? Says the doctor. Yes,
Tom says. I keep looking at the woman. She gives me a slight frown, but then her gaze slithers to Tom and understanding dawns. She gives me a small, almost indistinct nod.
Diana, are you coming?
Oh, yes. I break gazes with the woman,
and Tom and I walk into the room. I drive home. It is one of only a handful of times I've driven while Tom was in the car. Most times have been when he'd had too much to drink. A lot too much, because often he drove anyway. We weren't as vigilant about drunk driving in our day. But there were a couple of other times. Once, when we were newly married and on a road trip to visit his cousin in Bright in the Victorian countryside. Ollie was in the back seat of the car, just a toddler, and Tom was driving far too fast for my liking, so I demanded he slow down. Finally, he pulled over onto the dusty side of the road, wrenched up the handbrake and said, "Fine, if you never want to get there, you drive." He could be dreadfully hot-headed, Tom. I'd taken the wheel, and despite Tom's lack of faith, we did make it there, and in good time. He'd muttered and moaned about it for an hour or so, then calmed down like he always did. By the time we arrived, we were chuckling about it. I wonder if soon the rest of my memories of Tom will be catalogued like this. Memories of him as a father, memories of him as a grandfather, memories of fights, memories of joy, all of the memories, because he is gone. "When we get home, I'll get on the phone about a second opinion," I say, my voice full of authority. "And I will get a second opinion, a third one too. We'll go through the process and exhaust all the avenues. But in the end, Tom will die. Somehow I know this. He won't be in his 90s. He won't even be in his 70s. He will die, and I will have to live." "When we get home," Tom replies, "I want to go to bed." We pull to a stop at a red traffic light, and I turn to look at him properly. His eyes are shiny, the bottom lid heavy, threatening to spill. "Okay," I say, "we'll go to bed." The tears spill as I pull out of the intersection. I leave him to it, his own personal grieving process. He doesn't need me telling him everything will be okay when we both know it won't. Instead, I give his hand a firm squeeze. My role is clear to me now. I will be the strong one. I'll be good at this. I am aware of my limitations. I'm not warm. I'm not especially kind. But I can be strong. I can allow Tom to slip away knowing I will be all right. This I can give him. At home, Tom goes right upstairs. I do too. But while he heads for the bedroom, I tell him I need a quick shower. In the bathroom, I set the shower running, and I strip off my clothes, and I stand under the stream of water and cry. I cry until I don't know which is water and which is tears. I cry until I'm dry. By the time I get out of the shower, Tom is in bed. At first, I think he is asleep, but as soon as I crawl in beside him, his eyes open. "How are you going to live without me?" he says. We both chuckle, even as a tear slides from the corner of Tom's eye. "I won't," I say. And then he reaches for me, and we don't talk anymore. 1971. When Ollie was 4 months old, I got a job at the Star Theatre in Yarraville. The Star was unusually opulent for the area and was packed every Saturday night. Unique to the cinema was a baby room where babies were lined up in their carriages and each given a number. If a baby started crying, its number was flashed on the screen and its mother would come and collect it. Ollie was one of those babies. Like Meredith said, I figured out how to get a job and look after Ollie at the same time. I was surprised how good it felt to be able to do that. I wasn't completely self-sufficient, I didn't pay rent at Meredith's and I still slept in her shed, but I started to contribute toward bills and food. I worked Tuesday and Saturday nights to begin with. Tuesdays were busy, but Saturdays were nearly always fully booked, all 1,000 seats. I roamed between the ticket box and the concession stand as the foyer swelled with people.
I'd been to the Star before as an attendee, but there was a different buzz to working there. I liked it better. I felt like I was behind the scenes on a show or had a backstage pass to a concert. I saw people I knew from time to time, but they never saw me. I existed in a different world to them. Sometimes they looked directly at me, but still, they never saw me. I raced around the busy theatre, directing people in with a flashlight, serving popcorn. Once everyone was inside the movie, I'd often go to the baby area and look at the babies, all lined up. Seeing them, it was hard not to think about the babies of the girls at Orchard House. They would have been lined up like this in the hospital nursery before they were taken home by someone else. None of the girls thought they had a choice. I wished I could go back and tell them they did. During the movie, if I heard a baby cry, I'd try to settle them for a few minutes before I'd run their number up to the screening room to flash over the screen. 9 times out of 10, I did settle them. Ollie always slept, even then my simple, content boy. I was watching over the babies one night when a young man came out of the cinema, 20 minutes after the film started. I made my way to the concession stand, where he was headed.
"Just a popcorn, please," he said.
"Small, medium or large?" The young man blinked at me, looking me full in the face. It took me a moment to place the young man as Tom Goodwin, the plumber who had visited my parents' house a couple of times. According to my father, he was a good worker. He wasn't a handsome man, but he had clear blue eyes, a good crop of hair, a great smile. He was on the shorter side, and he did nothing to conceal his intrigue at finding me working at a candy bar in Yarraville.
"I know you," he said.
"And I know you," I smiled. "Tom, right?" He cocked his head. I could actually see the cogs turning in his head.
"What are you doing here?"
"What does it look like?"
"I haven't seen you around for a while," he said eventually.
I recognized it for what it was, a question. For that exact reason, my first instinct was to be vague in my response. "I've been busy," sprang to my lips, as did "I was over in Europe for a while." But I forced those words away. Suddenly I understood what Meredith had said about the freedom of having nothing to lose. "I went away to have a baby." I loved the way Tom didn't try to conceal his surprise. He blinked, long and slow, and then blinked again. He actually took a step back. It was, I am certain, the fact that I admitted it rather than the fact that it happened that caused his astonishment. "A boy," I said. "Oliver. He's over there in that basket."
"He's here?"
To my surprise, Tom walked over to the baby area and peered into Ollie's basket.
"This little fella?"
He gazed down at him and his face softened.
"And your family?"
"They're thrilled." I laughed, and Tom surprised me by laughing back. He had a great laugh, a full-bodied, hearty laugh that came from the well of his stomach and the cavern of his chest.
"So how are you supporting yourself then?"
"I live in a shed in Spotswood in the backyard of my father's disgraced cousin. I cook and clean for her, and I'm working here for money."
He frowned. "You're kidding."
"Afraid not. But don't worry about me, I'm doing just fine. Very well, actually."
I glanced at the clock. I'd been talking too long. I had to get things cleaned up and organized before the intermission.
I grabbed a popcorn container and made Tom a large one and handed it to him. "That'll be $1, I said to him.
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a fistful of crumpled notes, handing the lot to me without even glancing at them.
"You'd better get back in there. You're going to miss the movie."
He jerked slightly, looking over his shoulder as if he'd forgotten where he was. Then he looked back at me, and gave me the best smile I'd ever seen.
Problem is, I don't want to miss what's happening out here.
Chapter 37. Lucy. The present. Wakes are always an interesting affair. Anything that mixes family and alcohol usually is. When I arrive at the Half Moon after Diana's funeral, Ollie is looking more relaxed with a beer in hand, occasionally even chuckling at something someone has said. Football is on the television in the background, which also provides some normality to the abnormal occasion. Nettie, too, seems more together than at the funeral. Edie takes pride of place in her lap, and Nettie offers her what appears to be a pink lemonade. I'm glad to see her issues with us haven't extended to our children. Say what you want about Nettie, but she was a devoted aunt. I have to love her for that. Patrick has sunk at least half a dozen beers since I arrived, a good hour after everyone else, and it has to be said he's looking a bit worse for wear. I suppose I can't blame him. I'd like to throw back a few too, but between chasing the kids around and ordering them to get up from under the tables, there isn't a lot of time. Harriet and Archie have kicked their shoes off and are scampering around on the floors, where the dirt is forming a paste with the spilled drinks. Soon someone will break a glass, one of the kids will step on it, and we'll all be headed to the hospital. Actually, it would be a relief to get out of here. Hey, I say, finding Ollie at the bar. He has the glassiness of a man a few beers in, and he seems somber, but then he has just attended his mother's funeral. Are you okay? Apart from the fact that it's your mum's funeral, your business is failing, and the fact that we're financially ruined? Actually, he says, I was just thinking about how bad my eulogy was today.
It wasn't bad.
He cocks his head. Come on,